My name is Jeff Lerner, and I interview elite performers from a wide range of disciplines, entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, scientists, artists, and more. This is Unlock Your Potential. Hey there, Jeff Lerner here, and today I'm doing something special for our episode of Unlock Your Potential. My team and I, we have curated a collection of some of the most powerful conversations that we've had on the show about building, maintaining, and growing the strongest possible relationships. And you're gonna hear some key segments from some of the best conversations we've had on this show. Now, if you're a follower of mine, then you know how important my relationship with my wife, Jacqueline, is. I consider it the bedrock of my success, and I consider it the bedrock of my joy and fulfillment in the work that I do and the life that I live. You might think me a traditionalist per se, but I just, based on my own life experience, I deeply believe that no matter how happy we might be able to become going it alone and being on our own, that there is just another level of happiness and joy and fulfillment that can be unlocked through the forging fire of learning to navigate this life with a partner. It is hard, it is challenging, but I think it is a huge growth opportunity. I think it is something that is preset in the human condition to challenge us to get better, but it is difficult. And that's why I'm sharing some of the best insights we've gotten here on the show about how to do it in a way that actually makes your life stronger and your relationships stronger. So here's some highlights that we're about to go into. First of all, Amy Porterfield is gonna be sharing expertise on actually how to talk about your plans and your dreams with the key people that you need to get enrolled, particularly how to deal maybe with an unsupportive spouse and how to have those hard conversations with your partner. We're also going to talk to Dr. Robert Waldinger, who oversaw or currently oversees still the longest study on happiness in the world out of Harvard. We're going to be talking about delaying gratification and practical ways to build fulfilling lifelong relationships, not just a primary relationship, but a set of relationships. We will then be moving on to Julian Treasure, who will take us on a journey into effective communication, discussing the impact of technology on relationships, how to find the right balance between being right and being close. Sometimes those are opposites, and we need to learn how to have them coexist. And then he's going to actually help us better understand the filters that shape our listening experience. The majority of communicating is actually about effective listening, and he's one of the world's foremost experts on sound and listening. We will then talk to Larry Hagner, who will be sharing insights on intentional fatherhood. He's going to delve into the three types of men and how to transform from a zombie, just going through the motions, one step at a time, one foot in front of the other, to an actual liver and executor of a purposeful life. The conversation with Larry is a full-on roadmap for meaningful and intentional living. And then we're gonna have a little fun talking to Dorian Solot and Marshall Miller, who are experts on sexual and relational health and have a unique perspective on communication. We're gonna get into some interesting subjects like the female orgasm. They actually offer coaching tips on effective communication and helping you have challenging conversations with your partner. They can actually lead to deeper intimacy. Anyway, it's going to be a fantastic mashup of some of the best conversations we've had here on the show, and I cannot wait to send you off to enjoy them.
If you're going to leave your 9-to-5 job and go out on your own, you got to be careful who you tell, because 99% of the people you tell, whether they love you or not, are going to tell you all the reasons why this will not work. They've never done it, but they're going to tell you all the reasons why you shouldn't do it, because it's just their fears, their own perspective. Keep your dreams tight to your chest. Only share it with the people that you know will actually help you keep moving forward. That's a mistake that a lot of people make. They tell too many people, get too many opinions. They never take action.
You're saying stuff that it's like, I have different words maybe, but it's the same stuff we say. You know, the people that love you typically want to keep you safe.
Yes.
More than they want to see you happy. And that doesn't mean they don't want to see you happy, but they only want to see you happy if it doesn't mean that you're unsafe.
Absolutely.
And so they, because their perception of entrepreneurship is that it's scary and risky and dangerous, they're not weighting it towards your potential happiness. They're weighting it towards your potential danger. And so how do you know though? How do you know who are the people in your life that are the few that you should entrust? Because I agree with you, you shouldn't tell no one, because then there's no one to feel, frankly, there's no one that you'll be embarrassed of if you fail, if you never told them what you were doing. So who are the ones that you tell?
So you tell those people that you know have your absolute back no matter what. You're looking for the ultimate cheerleaders in your life. And that might not be a spouse. And let's talk about that for a second. But before we get there, for me, I told my husband, literally, he thinks I could do anything. Same with my mom. She thinks I could land on Mars. Like she is such a supporter. And then my best friend. I literally only told three people because I knew most people could absolutely not take my dream and not squash it in the moment. And I was so vulnerable at that time, I would have believed anything I heard. So I knew I had to protect myself. But there's this debate that I've been talking about on some podcast about, especially women, but this could work for men as well. You tell your spouse and your spouse doesn't want you to do it. And you just said it's because they want to keep you safe. They want to keep the family safe.
Yeah, they want to keep themselves safe too.
Yeah, just not you. It's like the whole family unit. And you going out on your own might mean that you lose money because you're not in your 9-to-5 job. Or maybe if you are staying home with the kids, it might mean that now the kids might get neglected. And, you know, I want you to be a stay-at-home mom or dad or whatever it might be. And so there's all these reasons.
Can I interject another reason that I think needs to be said?
Please.
They might sense that the person you need to become to succeed at what you're wanting to do is going to be intimidating or have outgrown them.
That is something that I think I was going to bring that up, that I really do think you're going to change and that scares somebody else. I don't think they consciously think that. It's a very subconscious thing. Life's going to change. You're going to change. You're going to start doing things that are outside of our circle of how we do things. That is a threat.
And by the way, they're right.
It's totally right.
Entrepreneurship will totally change you.
I don't even know. I don't even know who I am. Like I would never recognize the woman I am today. That is not me 14 years ago. My husband has seen me dramatically change. And sometimes he probably wishes I was a little different. You know, I'm so aggressive, so go for it, competitive, all that. He's like, whoa, where's the girl I married? But he's super supportive of it. But here's the thing. This is the controversial part. I believe if you go to your spouse, whether you're the wife going to the husband, a wife to a wife, husband to a husband, or the husband going to a wife, I don't even care the dynamic. But if you're going to your significant other and they do not think you should do it, they are not in support of it. The controversial thing that I bring up is you've got to find a way to do it. Because here's why. If you don't, you will lay in bed at night starting to resent the person laying next to you. You will definitely think that they have squashed your dreams. Now, if they don't want you to do it, there's other ways you can get around it. Number one, you might need to go to therapy. Like you guys might need to work it out, because who wants to be married to someone that holds them back? The other thing though, is there's other ways to get started, like with a side hustle. And they might just want you to slow down and kind of ease into it. I started with a side hustle. I say that I had a side hustle that turned into an $80 million business. I had a few clients on the side while I was still in my 9-to-5 job. That gave me a little confidence to think, okay, I'm starting to think like an entrepreneur. I'm starting to put the pieces together. So when I left my 9-to-5 job, I had two clients. Did it pay my salary? No, but then I was able to hustle to get more. So you've got to work something out, even if your significant other doesn't believe in you, because the answer is not to do it. That absolutely has to be taken off the table.
I agree with you. I mean, I think that a successful marriage is based on your advocacy for the best version of the person you're married to.
Amen. That's so beautifully put. And if that's not the case, then maybe there's some other things, I know we're going deep here, but some other things you need to examine in your relationship, because this is probably not the first time something came up that you feel as though you can't go after what you want. And so I think you need to kind of examine what's going on. But I bring this up because it happens a lot. A lot of people haven't gone after starting their own business because they feel as though they don't have the support they need. And sometimes it's not going to come from your spouse and it's going to come from something else. But One thing I did when I was still in my 9-to-5 job, I actually started seeking out a mastermind. I wanted to be around other entrepreneurial people because I'd never been around entrepreneurs like that. I wanted to be a part of it. I wanted to sit at their table. So I paid for it. So that's another thing. If you don't have the support that you think you need at home, but you're going to go for it, you figured out how you're going to do that, get into a group of people, whether you pay for it or it's free. Surround yourself with people that are doing bigger and better things than you. It's absolutely necessary for your success.
I mean, I think my show gets, I don't know, 1,000 plus listens per episode. So let's assume 1,000 people are going to hear this. I'll bet you 50 of them have a dream that they don't know how to talk to their spouse about, or they tried once and it didn't go well and they haven't brought it back up.
It's such a big thing that in my book, I put scripts of how to have the conversation.
You did. Oh my God. That's what I was going to say is like, can we dig into how to have the conversation? But you've already done that in your book.
Yes. And one of the things that I say in the scripts that I give my readers is that you can't focus on like, I want to create a business that I'm going to sell this widget for this much money, and this is how I'm going to sell it. It's not the features of the business. It genuinely is the heart and the dream and the desire that you have to focus on. You have to go for the heart versus the brain when you have these conversations, because you can't say my goal is to make $100,000 by this date. You have no proof that that is ever going to happen, and they're going to know that. But I think they need to understand what's underlying. What does it mean for the family? What does it mean for you? What does it mean in general? And so I think that's where the conversation starts.
Yeah. And one of the core concepts that I know that you're intimately familiar with as an entrepreneur is that we train ourselves to ask how, not if.
Amen.
And that's the conversation with your spouse is like, listen, how may mean not now.
Yeah.
But how can we figure out how this can be a thing? Because I'm not going to be able to let it go. It's any more than I can let go the fact that my eyes are brown. It's just a part of me, and it'll turn into resentment if we don't figure out how.
That's a beautiful way to put it. I love that. And I think there has to be some honesty. And here's the truth. It might not be one conversation. Right. It might be 3, 4, 5 conversations. And someone might look at me and say, oh, Amy, it's easy for you to talk about this. You had a husband that wanted you to quit before you even quit. Like, he was ready for me to go out on my own. I traveled a lot in my job and I was newly married, so I hardly saw my husband. But the truth is, most of my students have spouses that don't support them. It's a conversation I have every single week with my students. So I know what that looks like. You know, I have a student, her name is Rachel, and she's a pharmacist, or was a pharmacist for many, many years. It was the job her parents wanted her to have. She went after it. They were so proud of her. She made a lot of money as a pharmacist. And then COVID hit and all hell broke loose. She's like, it was the craziest time in my life being a pharmacist during COVID. No one wants to be that.
Right.
And she realized she was miserable. So on the side, as a side hustle, she started buying property and turning it into luxury Airbnbs. And that's how she started to make money on the side. She needed actually to take her brain off of the pharmacy situation. When it started to make a little money, she went to her husband and said, I want to do this full time. And he laughed. He's like, what? No, like, you're a pharmacist. You've got a really good, solid job. You can't quit to buy property and turn it into luxury Airbnbs. But she was determined and she stuck with that side hustle till it started making more money than her pharmacy job. And her husband's like, ooh, you should make that a full-time thing. Like, she just got to work, put her money where her mouth was, and she proved him wrong. And I hope sometimes she rubs it in his face, joking. But that's how she did it. There's ways to get around this, but starting now to me is the only option. You got to get something going.
The health of our relationships is at the core of the quality of our life.
Basically, we've followed the same people, the same families for 85 years. And our big question was, what actually makes people thrive as they go through life? And we were blown away when we began to find that, yes, blood pressure mattered and cholesterol mattered and health in general mattered, but that the biggest predictor of who was going to be not just happy, but healthy was the quality of people's relationships with other people. And then many other studies began to find the same thing, and we began to have a lot of confidence in this as a very robust finding about adult life.
I just have like a deja vu moment of the other time in my life when somebody referred to the greatest predictor of the quality of life, or the, you know, the probability of a positive human outcome. And it was the well-known, and I'm sure you're familiar with, the Stanford Marshmallow Experiment, right?
Oh yeah.
Very familiar with, which says that essentially makes the same claim about the attribute of delayed gratification, the ability to delay gratification. And so what traits allow a person to create good relationships so that they can then create a good quality of life? And perhaps delayed gratification is one of them based on that other experiment.
Well, you're pointing out something interesting that nobody's actually ever pointed to before. And I think it is related. So, you know, the question is, why don't we pay attention to relationships? I mean, you know, we pay attention to money and fame and winning prizes and all that as supposedly making us happy, which they don't. But why don't we pay attention to relationships? And one of the factors might be that relationships are complicated. They take persistence. They take grit. They take delaying gratification. So, you know, if my friend does something I'm not so happy with, do I have to explode right away or have a negative reaction, or can I step back, think about it, really, you know, sit with it a while? It's that kind of living with complexity, delaying my reaction until I have a chance to think about it, choose how I want to react. Then all of that may be related to the marshmallow experiment.
Yeah.
Where these kids are asked, you know, don't just grab for the marshmallow. Think about it. You're going to get something extra if you wait a little while, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think there's, delayed gratification is probably a skill for building quality relationships. Like you said, not blowing up because somebody upsets you, but, you know, having the larger context of the relationship in mind. And delayed gratification is also an aspect of relationships, that they themselves are a long-term, slow growth, compounding investment that really bears more fruit the more time you give it. And it's decades down the road. So it's interesting. You know what I mean? It's both something that, so it's something that helps you build quality relationships. And then it's also probably something that helps you appreciate and value relationships over time. So yeah, I wonder if they really are two ways of saying the same thing in a sense.
Well, they're probably not the same thing, right? Because delayed gratification can be one part of relationships, but another part of relationships is just plain old fun. It's like, right now, am I having a good time, right? And that's really important in some relationships, not all. So I would say that there's never any one magic key to anything, right? And when you study thousands of lives, that's what you learn. But they do know that being able to delay gratification is a great asset in your life. Similarly, nurturing relationships that includes some delayed gratification, that's also a huge asset in your life. And we can talk about that at your work life as well as your private life. So they're related, but they're not identical.
So has the study revealed, you know, any of the tactics or the practices that actually go into forging quality lifelong relationships? Because I mean, obviously the study has revealed that lifelong relationships are the key to a good life, but has it really taught us how to actually create those?
Yes. And a lot of it has to do with small actions to maintain the connections you have. So one of the things we saw is that many people who had perfectly good relationships in their 20s didn't do anything to take care of them. And you would watch these perfectly good relationships wither away and die from neglect. But the people who were really good at this would just do small actions. They made sure to see or talk to friends, family, that regularly. And we can do that, right? You could, at the end of this podcast, you could think of somebody you miss or would like to connect with, and just send them a text or send them an email. And you'll be amazed at how many times people will come back to you saying, I'm so glad you reached out. Not every time, but most of the time. And the people who were best at this did that. The other thing is that the people who were best at this, who, let's say you don't have enough people in your life, the people who were good at developing new relationships were the people who invested in what we call social capital. They joined clubs. They went to houses of worship. They volunteered for good causes, for political campaigns. They joined bowling leagues, anything to sort of do something that you care about alongside other people. And that was the best way to develop new relationships and bring new people into your life.
Yeah, one thing that struck me on my, whatever it was, fourth or fifth viewing of your TED Talk, and I love you know, re-watching, re-listening to anything, you always catch new things. But one thing that I caught this most recent listening or viewing was when you talked about replacing relationships, that, you know, people that, let's say they retire and they lose their peer group or their workplace friends, it's the people that proactively replace those workmates with playmates.
Yeah.
In their new environment, and essentially never allowing that void to develop in your life.
Right, right. And or recognizing the void and doing something about it. Like a lot of people take their workmates for granted. And then when they retire, they look around and say, oh my God, where did everybody go? Yeah. And they realize, oh, I took all these people for granted. And then they get busy. The people who are happiest in retirement get busy making new relationships. And I think that's, you know, you think about it, if we move for a job, move to a different city, again, we have to start over. So there are these very particular actions you can take to make new relationships. They're tried and true. They really work.
Can you share them briefly? If somebody missed that day in kindergarten of like making a friend 101?
Yeah. Well, it's what I said. It's volunteering. It's joining clubs. It's joining organizations. You know, if you think about it, when you get to high school or college, the first thing they offer you is the chance to join clubs. And it's because they know that's a way for people to start getting connected to each other. And when you move to a new city, similarly, do this at work. And one of the ways we can do this is to just notice things, be curious about other people. So let's say you're at work and you notice that somebody has something displayed on their desktop, or if you're on Zoom, they have something in their background. You know, you ask about it, be curious. People love it when you're curious about them. People love to talk about themselves. It's a very good way to strike up conversations and to start developing new relationships. So curiosity is a huge driver of new relationships.
So I'm curious, has the data revealed any correlation between your aptitude at creating relationships and maintaining and nurturing relationships and measurable professional outcomes?
Yes, it has. And there's good research, not just from us, but from other studies that show that the people who have at least one friend at work are better performers at work. They're more engaged in their jobs. And of course, they're happier. They're less likely to leave their jobs for some other job because you have people who matter to you at work. So all these parameters matter. That's actually useful information for entrepreneurs, for people building companies, and for CEOs, that these connections at work aren't distractions. They're the opposite. They actually build productivity and engagement of your workforce.
And retention.
And retention.
Which in the modern workplace as a CEO, I mean, that's, you're all about, it's expensive to find and train good people. How do I hold on to them? And it sounds like foster an environment of personal connection.
Exactly. Exactly.
We touched on earlier delayed gratification as one of the possible skills that seem to be a really significant input into the ability to build great relationships over the course of a life. You also talked about just you know, consistency. It sounds like consistency of communication, just the actual staying in touch with people, not letting too much, you know, water run under the bridge. Are there any other skills or practices that have revealed themselves through your research of like, these are the contributions towards building great relationships over time that you need to be making?
Yeah. So one I mentioned before a little bit, which is curiosity. Let yourself be curious about other people. And particularly when they say something that worries or upsets you, be curious as opposed to just reacting. The other thing is that if we think about ongoing relationships, including at work, everybody is changing all the time. So we are changing day to day. That means that our relationships are going to change. And that means that we want to be sensitive to that, be curious, interested about how people are changing. Maybe their interests are changing. Maybe something's changing at home. Or maybe they want to take a new path in their career development, and to be curious, interested, and maybe supportive of that goes a long way toward keeping a relationship strong and stable. That includes with your employees.
When something upsets you, developing the responsiveness rather than the reactiveness to say, I'm going to be curious about that. I'm going to find out more. I'm actually going to lean into it, but not aggressively. That sounds like something the world of today, like, really, really needs to take to heart.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Listening is, you know, a tragically underestimated skill. Most people think it's a capability. It's not. We don't teach it in schools at all. I mean, I'm not aware of any schools that do. There may be one or two, but it's really rare. And yet it's a crucial life skill. You know, if you want to be a great salesperson, any top salesperson will tell you the most important part of the sales conversation is not the speaking, it's the listening, where you understand what the needs of the other person are. You're really getting them, and you're able then to sell in an effective way as opposed to, you know, being bombastic or irrelevant. So listening is crucial. At home, I mean, what's the biggest complaint in relationships? He or she never listens to me. It's crucial in business relationships, where it's actually one of the skills that people recruit on now. But strangely, when they've recruited their good listeners, there's no appraisal on it. You know, the 360 degree doesn't say, is this person right, a good listener? It's just forgotten about. People don't train on it. They don't appraise on it. They don't reward for it. So it's taken for granted. The moment we get into an organization, listening is just like, oh yeah, we all do that. Well, we don't. Many people don't understand it's a skill that you can master, develop, become really good at. And there are so many benefits to doing that. But it's actually quite interesting, Jeff. If you look at the numbers, the TED Talk on speaking that I did has been seen by 5 times as many people as the TED Talk on listening. And that's interesting to me.
Yeah, that seems telling.
Yeah, because listening to me is it's the core skill. You know, it's the foundational skill. I really think it's difficult to be a great speaker if you're not a good listener. And so many people aren't these days. I think if you look around in the world, in politics, in international relations, never have we needed listening more than we do now in the world.
There's a skill of listening, but then there's probably also the skill of having people feel like you're listening, which maybe aren't exactly the same thing.
They're very similar, I think.
Okay.
And, you know, people often say, I can't get heard. You know, I feel frustrated. I can't make a difference I want to make in the world because people aren't listening to me. How do I get them to listen to me? And the answer is you listen to them. Listen to them, ask questions. And you can move a conversation. You know, if you don't feel comfortable in the conversation, you can ask questions that move it in a direction towards something you do feel, you know, that's really interesting. Have you ever thought about this aspect of it, which is something I do know about? Now let's talk about that. You know, so if you're actually listening to somebody and engaging with them, which means looking at them, which is something we are not very good at, you know, tap, tap, tap. I am listening to you. No, you're sending a text. It's not the same thing. So, you know, Scott Peck said, you cannot truly listen to another human being and do anything else at the same time, which is quite a big challenge. This life that we live is so distracted. You know, I love that book by Nir Eyal, Indistractable, where he's dealing with all this stuff, because there are so many huge organizations who are hell-bent on getting your attention, my attention, everybody's attention. That's the currency they're after. They want us on that screen looking at that, going, oh, somebody might have tagged me, or, you know, maybe I better reply to something, or, you know, all this stuff going on, which is grabbing our attention away from the people we're with. And there's a great talk by Sherry Turkle on this called Alone Together, a TED Talk and a book she wrote, which is saying really this, that technology, far from bringing us together as a great global village, is actually driving us apart, because we're locking ourselves into these conversations with people we barely know who aren't here at the moment, and ignoring the people next to us, which is, you know, I wonder how many people sit in bed late at night doing email next to their partner. I mean, we've all done it. Mm-hmm. And so that device, which is kind of glued to our hand, that can be very, very pernicious. And it's a real threat to our ability to listen. And of course, the other thing technology is doing is it's pandering to one of the great human needs, which I think is terribly destructive in our communication. And that's the desire to be right. And we have so much of that going on now. And it's deepened by the internet, because we have these silos of people who have increasingly extreme entrenched views. And because there's a few hundred of them in that place, they all reinforce it. They were, I knew, right, I was right. 100 agree with me. Yeah, but there are millions who don't, but you don't go and talk to them, you know? So we get these kind of silos of increasingly frenzied and potentially quite difficult and even violent views, which is very unfortunate. You know, Harville Hendricks, who's a man I have a lot of respect for, a relationship counselor and author from America, said, you can either be right or be in a relationship.
Yeah, so my therapist actually references Harville Hendricks often. Hendricks and Gottman, and there's a number of them, but he frames it as, he'll ask couples directly. He's like, look, what do you want more? Do you want to be right or do you want to be close? And it's a binary choice. And as you were speaking, I was thinking about how it all kind of connects together, because the more right you believe you are, the less you listen, and the less other people feel listened to, which means the more they will naturally go seek places where they do feel listened to, which are going to be these insular silos where they feel right. And the reason they feel listened to isn't necessarily even because they're being listened to, but just because they're being agreed with. And so, like, we're fragmented. So you know, I'm sort of connecting the dots here and agreeing with you that, yeah, at the core of a lot of the fragmentation and polarization of society, probably one could argue it's the breakdown of our listening to each other. And that's why we're not close as a society.
Because, you know, the upshot of conscious listening to me is always understanding. So I may disagree with you thoroughly, Jeff, but I can say, Jeff, I totally disagree, but I can see why you believe that. Now, that is validation, which again is an important part of Harville Hendricks's work, where you don't have to agree with somebody, but you can listen to them, validate that they believe that. And that's, you know, in their world, that's a sensible thing for them to believe, and agree to disagree. I think Barack Obama said, I will listen to you, especially if we disagree, which is quite a brave statement. And not many people would go along with that, because we don't like to be challenged. We don't like our cage to be shaken and to be stirred into maybe reassessing something that we really believe in. I always say we listen through a set of filters. And I put these into the TED Talk, the third one. So things like the language we speak, which has filters in it, the culture we're born into, the values, attitudes, and beliefs that we gather along the way from our parents, friends, role models, whoever it might be. And then in any given situation, we might have intentions, expectations, emotions going on. All of these things affect how well we can listen to somebody else. So timing is very important because that set of filters is unique to each individual. My listening is different to yours, Jeff. And that's a really important thing for anybody who wants to communicate to understand, because it's the most common mistake I see being made is assuming everybody listens like I do. They don't. They absolutely don't. And once you get that, you get that you're speaking into a listening which is unique to that person at that moment. Mm. Then you can start to tailor the way you speak and ask yourself the question, what's the listening I'm speaking into? And that's a big part of my work, is that sensitivity.
So it kind of reminds me of like the love languages concept, where you're trying to understand how they're going to be best able to receive what it is that you want to give. So do you have a taxonomy or a framework for styles of listening, or you know, easy to reference names that we can apply to these styles and try to remember them in the moment?
I don't think it's as complicated as that. You know, what I train people to do is simply to ask that question over and over and over again in every conversation and get into the habit of asking that question. And it is, in my experience anyway, simply true that if you ask the question over and over again, what's the listening? What's the listening I'm speaking to here? You become more and more sensitive to it. Don't ask me how. I mean, it may be, you know, tiny micro expressions or body language or pheromones, I don't know, whatever it is, or combination of all sorts of cues, subtle cues. Obviously, there are going to be things which are much clearer. Like if I'm standing on stage talking to an audience of young people, I have to change the way I speak and my cultural references. If I'm talking to a group of people who are listening to me and they speak a foreign language and they're having to translate, which I've done many, many times, I have to speak more slowly and more clearly because they're doing a really tough job of translating simultaneously in their heads at the same time as listening to me. So it's a question of being sensitive to the group of people or the person you're speaking to. You know, if you're speaking to somebody who speaks really, really slowly, then if you're speaking like this, you're absolutely at the wrong wavelength. You know, you're going to intimidate them. So we do, you know, there's a degree to which this is natural. Human beings match and mirror other human beings. They tend to make similar gestures. They tend to adopt similar postures and so forth. So a lot of this is automatic. It's just being a person. But you can get really good at it if you ask that question, what's the listening, all the time, instead of just blithely assuming that everybody listens like I do and the way I normally speak is going to work in all situations. Not true.
You know, one thing we haven't, you sort of touched on, but it's the L in hail is love. Mm. And I have in my notes, wishing well for people. And and I wrote this down. I assume you said it. This tempers honesty and neutralizes judgment.
Yes. I mean, I really believe that you can't love and judge simultaneously. I think it's very difficult to hold those two things.
You said that in the TED Talk, right?
Yeah. And that's my experience in life. If you're judging somebody, you're suspending your love for them at that moment. And again, that often comes down to the need to be right or the need to be justified in some way, or the need to look good, perhaps. I don't know. It can be any of those things. Loving in that sense, not romantic love, but what Christians would call agape or Buddhists would call loving kindness. I mean, there's lots and lots of expressions of this in religions all over the world. It comes down to wishing somebody well. And, you know, I had a friend many, many years ago who gave me a wonderful exercise on this that I'll pass on now. And that is to formulate in your mind and just say over and over again the words, bless you. Doesn't have to be religious. It can be if you're religious, but it can just be a well-wishing thing. And instead of walking around a city and thinking dark and horrible thoughts about the people who bump into you or step into your way or, you know, cause you some sort of obstruction in what you want, then you can be thinking, bless you. And if you do that over and over again, it is extraordinary what happens. You start feeling that you're walking several inches above the ground. Everything becomes light. You meet somebody's gaze And what happens? You smile at each other because you weren't thinking a horrible thing about them. So you're not shiftily trying to avoid people seeing what's going on inside your head. It's a very lovely exercise. It's very cleansing. It's very simple to do. And it really gives you a lightness of being, which is enormously enjoyable. So I recommend that to anybody, as opposed to, you know, the constant editor critic that we have in our head judging other people. So loving, I think, is very important. And of course, as I said in the TED talk, it is needed to temper honesty. You know, we don't need to say, "Oh, you look terrible today," to somebody. It's not really necessary. You know, it might be helpful, but if you're loving, then perhaps you just withhold that kind of thing. We don't have to be brutally honest the whole time. That's not a part of being clear and straight in the sense of honesty that I'm using it.
Hey there, real quick, I just wanted to let you know, I have been concentrating a lot lately on providing tons of value to my text message community. This could be random thoughts, this could be letting you be the first to know about an event I'm planning or a special I'm running or a free training I'm hosting. Anyway, just shoot me a text to get subscribed. The number is 702-996-3926. Thanks so much. Let's get back to the podcast.
If you look at the world around me, some of it makes me absolutely freaking sick, man. And Meg Meeker said this. Meg Meeker is the best-selling author of Strong Fathers, Strong Daughters, My Father, the Hero. She's a huge advocate for dads. She even said this. She said, if you put an intentional father under every household in America, the world would change overnight. The entire world. If you just did it in our country alone, right? If you look at the statistics of bad things that happen to kids, it usually came from either a fatherless environment or it came from a dad who wasn't intentional and was just a zombie. Those are the two factors. Nothing against moms. Moms, oh my God. Strong mother in the house? Yes, awesome. Strong dad in the house or not? That will make or break a society. Sorry, not sorry to inform you. Google the statistics. They speak for themselves. It's like 88% of incarcerated people come from a broken home where there was no father or an abusive one. So that impact is really real. And that's not even including teen suicides, drug use, pregnancy, rapist, all these things. But here's the thing. I'm a very empathetic, compassionate, approachable human being. And I love people and I love to get people at their heart. But there are some times where I want to punch you in the face as an individual, because I'm like, if you don't see what's at stake here, there's a serious problem. So like, let me give you an example. There are three types of men out there, three types of human beings, but let's just talk about men. There's the victim, there's the zombie, and there's the executor. And all of us can identify with one of those three, and I'll explain each one. And chances are is you are probably one of those three in different areas. Mm. So you might be a victim in your marriage, but you might be an executor in your finances, right? You might be a victim in your finances, but you're an executor in your health, right? You might be a zombie in your parenting, but you're an executor in owning your business and creating like a real estate empire or something like that, right? So the victim will tell you every single reason why they can't be successful. I come from a broken home. My mom was married three times, so that's why I couldn't figure out how to be married. My mom was a narcissist alcoholic, so like I was never safe to talk about my feelings, so therefore I don't talk about my feelings and I can't be vulnerable with anybody. That's actually me I'm talking about, but I do the opposite because I'm not the victim. Right. There was a time in my life years and years ago, I was that, and that was my story. And guess what? Victims will not only tell you why they can't be successful, but they subconsciously look for proof. So like if they say, I'm not a good communicator because I was raised that way, I could never communicate, I don't have the skills. And then when I have a blow up with my wife, I'd be like, see, I told you I can't communicate. Mm-hmm. Like literally it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that's the victim. The content zombie is a step above the victim, because now they're just like, I'm kind of tired of being a victim. I'm tired of my life being like this. So I'm going to read books. I'm going to consume podcasts. I'm going to watch YouTube videos. So they're information, 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 right? They're hungry for the information. these are like, I love when people come and join us and they'll be like, dude, like I listen to, and I'm not kidding, I listen to 6 hours of podcasts a day. I'm like, God bless. Why? Is anything like in your life moving, or is it just information in, right? So the content zombie is hungry, but they're usually not doing anything about it. They're like, I'm reading all these books, I'm listening to all these podcasts, but like my marriage isn't getting better. My patience isn't getting better. My health isn't getting better. I don't know what's wrong. Well, it's because you haven't chosen one strategy to double down on and then go do it like the executor does. So like, I'll give you an example. So like, hey, listen, if you want to be a more patient father, one strategy is you've got to have a solid morning routine, because patience actually starts when your feet hit the ground in the morning. It does not start when your kids are acting out. It actually starts by you getting your head right, your physicality right, everything right before the day starts, right? So that's where patience actually starts. The other thing too is like, so that's a tactic. Be like, hey, listen, if you want to improve your patience just for right now, all I want you to do is get a solid 15-minute morning routine to set your mind, your heart, and your body in the right direction. That's a tactic. The executor would be like, done, I'm doing it. That's what I'm going to do. And they do it and they're religious about it. So I think, unfortunately, the world, and right now with the information at our fingertips, the world is filled with victims and it's filled with people who are consuming so much content that they don't even know what to do with.
To what do you attribute that distinction, that small percentile of people that are willing to go past zombie information consumer and into executor at a massive, disruptive, transformative level that, you know, probably ends up turning their whole life on its head if they really go all in with it? Like, what's the difference? And frankly, how do we bottle it and give it to more people?
You know, so there's a lot of things. So if I give you like maybe a buffet of things that I think what might really identify this person's courageous.
Yeah.
Right. This person doesn't have an ego that is protecting. They can override that ego or that voice of like, oh, you shouldn't need any help. You should just be able to do it on your own. You should know how to do it. What's wrong with you? Like all these stories, right? That we don't let other people in on. It takes a courageous person to be like, help here, please help.
Mm-hmm.
Like, listen, I think it's also a person who has a sense of urgency. Like there's one precious thing that I do not like to waste, and that's my time. I will never have an ego to the point where I'm not going to go into Lowe's and ask wherever I need to find something. I walk into Lowe's looking for something and I find the first person working there and I ask them what aisle it's in, because I don't want to be the guy walking up and down the aisles be like, where's the hell is the PVC pipe? Like, it's much easier to ask an expert, be like, where's the PVC pipe? It's aisle 17 on the right hand side, third row down, you'll see it right in the middle. Are you kidding me? You know how much time and frustration and mental bandwidth you just saved me just by telling me that? Let's go. Boom. Right. So it takes a courageous person. It also takes a person who has a sense of urgency to be like, I'm not going to waste this time. My kids are only going to be 17, 15, 9, and 7 once. I'm not going to waste this time. So I think it takes a person who's confident, who's courageous, who has a sense of urgency and knows that life should not be on what I call the drift. The drift is that wash, rinse, repeat. Unfulfilled, quiet desperation, isolation. I don't want to be on my deathbed being like, damn, coulda, woulda, shoulda. If you really think about what an executor does, is this is the way I make decisions now, is am I going to regret this when I'm on my deathbed? Because that day will come, right? I'll give you one really quick example. I took my oldest son out to Vegas because I had a bunch of podcast spots I was going to be on, that kind of thing. And when I travel, I take my kids with me. I'm really big with grabbing life by the balls and experiencing things, right? So I'm wearing this shirt right now. It says Gunship Helicopters. And that's because we found a place where you could actually shoot a machine gun out of an Apache helicopter in the desert of Vegas. And it was expensive. And my son was like, are you sure you want to do this? And I'm like, let me ask you something. I was like, we will never regret spending $1,600 to shoot a machine gun out of a helicopter for an hour, ever. You'll be 60, 70 years old and still remember doing that with your old man, and so will I. So I'm okay with that, right? It's like this sense of urgency to freaking live life, right? And I think a lot of people don't get that. But here's the warning I want to finish with. I encourage men. I desperately want to grab you by the shoulders, by your heart, by your soul and your mind to help you grab these skills of creating an extraordinary marriage, of creating an incredible connection with your kids, of leading yourself, optimizing everything in your life before it's too late. And what I mean by that is we look at preventative care in other areas of our life, like that's a no-brainer. Of course, I'm going to do that. Let me ask you, Jeff, when was the last time you were at the dentist?
It's probably been 2 months.
Okay. When was the last time you had an oil change?
It was the regularly scheduled one that my car told me to do on my last car. It was probably less than a year ago.
Would you wait till your engine was on fire before you're like, I should probably get the oil changed?
No, I would not do that.
No. And you probably wouldn't wait until your teeth are falling out of your head till you'd be like, I should probably go to the dentist.
This is true.
Yeah. Unfortunately, in other areas of our lives as men, we wait for that 911. And that's, And here's what I tell men. When guys come in and join us and they're like, my life is pretty good. There's some things that are but it's okay. I always tell guys that is your optimal learning because you're hungry and you're not desperate.
Yeah.
Think about it like this. You flip on your light switch, you see a spark in your house. You're like, ooh, I need to call the electrician. And it's a very easy call. You're like, hey man, I just, you know, just flipped on my switch and there's a spark. I think you should come out today and take a look at it. Is that cool? Yeah. Okay, cool. They come out, they fix it. Done deal. Versus like, oh, I saw a spark. Oh, I saw another spark. And then suddenly they're running out of their house, grabbing all their photo albums, their computer, everything. Oh my God, my house is on fire. Please send the fire department really, really quickly. They're desperate, right? They're freaking out. The amygdala, fight or flight or freeze, is going crazy because their house is on fire. So we're preventative in all these other areas of our life. But when it comes to our relationships, unfortunately, those can wait. It'll be okay. Man, don't wait. Don't wait. Treat it like your teeth. Treat it like your car. Treat it like the spark that you see when you flip on that light switch. Because if you are waiting, I just got a text this morning from a guy who told his daughter that him and his wife are getting a divorce. He just joined our program. He literally stated, if I would have joined their program 6 months ago, I probably wouldn't be having this conversation of divorce with my daughter. And I'm like, dude, and it's a perfect example of like waiting too long. Don't do that. It's the same thing with like, last thing I'll say is this. So many people, you mentioned the gym, right? So many people will wait until that heart attack or stroke until they're like, I should probably start taking better care of myself. Dude, you should have been taking better care of yourself 20 years ago, right? Don't wait until your chest is cracked open and they're doing bypass surgery. Like, get that stuff straight now, right? So that's the final message I really have for these guys.
I love it. I love it, man. A good friend of mine, he's actually our chief transformation officer at Entre, runs all of our personal development events and programs. And he always tells a story about taking, you know, hypothetical person taking their car in to the shop to say, yeah, man, there's this light on the dashboard that keeps telling me to check my engine. It's driving me nuts. It's bugging the hell out of me. Like, I need you to rip that light out. And the story, it's like, most of us that are neglecting preventative maintenance, we have the check engine light on somewhere in our life. We have a signal that's telling us, hey, this isn't working.
Right.
And a lot of us literally operatively are trying to rip the light out. We're just trying to get the signal to go away. We're trying to get our wife to stop complaining. We're trying to get our kids to be better behaved. We're trying to get our anxiety or our hypertension better managed or under control or medicated instead of recognizing those are check engine lights. The solution's actually under the hood. It's not just try to get the light to turn off. So thank you for what you said. Basically, people really struggle generally at communicating about sensitive, difficult, challenging, or emotionally charged things, right? And I have to imagine that communication is a huge piece of it. So is that something you work a lot with the students about, is like how to talk about this stuff?
Absolutely. Because there's such a feeling of like, this is awkward. And again, the more we're all used to texting, it's very tough in the middle of a sexual interlude to be like, I'm going to text you. I'm feeling now I'm going to send over an emoji. Like you actually are there in the moment, having to have those awkward conversations and having to communicate about things that can feel awkward or can feel unfamiliar. And helping people realize that that communication, you know, during sex, before sex, after sex, doesn't have to be these long formal conversations. I think people who are good at it have figured out these little tiny check-ins. So like, you know, is this good? Is this, you know, this is so hot. How does this feel? Like those little tiny phrases that help you find your way to the things that bring the two of you the most joy, the most pleasure. We talk a lot about orgasms, but fundamentally orgasms are not about orgasm as a goal, but just the sort of pleasure of the journey together.
And I think, I mean, even for adults, I mean, maybe, you know, just some quick tips we could give your listeners in terms of, you know, many adults are wondering how to have these same conversations. I mean, I think one of the tools that a lot of people have found helpful is just find an excuse to bring up the conversation. Like, oh, I was listening to this podcast and they were talking about blank. And the blank doesn't need to be exactly what, you know, the three of us are talking about today. It could be something more, you know, that you, the listener, have in mind that you're kind of like thinking about that you want to bring up to your partner, but you're not sure how to bring it up. And then see your partner's reaction. And if they're like, oh, like, tell me more, I'm curious, is very different than like immediate nose wrinkling, like, oh, don't go there. Because a lot of people do want to have those conversations, but are just haven't found a way to bring them up. And their partners, once they're brought up, are eager to have them.
So thank you, by the way. It sounds like you just directed our audience on how to use the conversation that we're having as a tool in their relationship. So glad we could provide that service for the audience. You can refer back to this conversation to have the conversation you want to have. But let's talk about this female orgasm thing, because I mean, you guys, of all the subjects you could have written a book about, that within the whole realm of sexuality, that was the book you wrote. I assume you at least thought about it somewhat as a marketer and said, okay, well, of all the subjects here, this is one is likely to get traction, or you knew that you get a lot of questions about that, or that there'd be a lot of interest. So assuming that, you know, that's a subject that holds interest for a lot of people, like, I haven't read the book. What's the core misconception or area of confusion, would you say, that needs to be cleaned up in that department such that it's enough of an issue that it was worth writing a book about?
If I were going to sum up one core misconception, I would say it's the equating of penis with vagina and not realizing that penis equals clitoris. That the clitoris is as important as the penis. It grows from the same tissue when we're embryos, and that having sex, having any kind of sexual interaction or interlude where you're not paying attention to the clitoris is exactly the same thing as having sex with a penis and just ignoring the penis, being like, that's not an important part to be involved right now.
And I think that, just to build on that, I think part of how that plays out for a lot of couples who are having intercourse with each other, and the, you know, in this case, let's say it's a man and a woman having intercourse with each other and the woman's not having orgasms, and they're like, why isn't this working? I mean, that was probably the most common question we get from people of all ages, and there's like, help. And there are any number of ways to make that work, but often involves figuring out how to get the clitoris involved. And one of the things we did for the book was survey 1,569 people. We had to laugh that like 16 was the final number in the survey that we got the results back. And we asked people we asked women in particular who are having orgasms during penetration, being like, okay, like, how does this, what works for you? Like, how are you making this work? And almost all the answers, there were some lucky ones that just, no matter what their partner was doing, the penetration alone, they're able to have an orgasm. But that was a fairly small percentage. But the much greater percentage just found some way to get clitoral stimulation at the same time, either using their own fingers, their hand, their partner's fingers, or using a vibrator. Using vibrator was slightly less common, but still worked just as well. Some people also found that they could find some way of sort of rubbing against their partner, getting clitoral stimulation during penetration that way, maybe against the base of their partner's penis or their partner's pubic bone. But finding some way of getting the clitoris involved just made it a lot easier to be able to have an orgasm. But a lot of people think, like, if, you know, it's not something, it's certainly not something that you see in porn or talked about in porn. It's not covered in high school sex ed. Like, how to make this work.
Yeah. So, okay. So I actually, I mean, I, I don't know if I'm ignorant or I'm ignorantly not ignorant. Probably a better way to say it. Is this really like a newsflash for people that like the clitoris is like the densest cluster of nerve endings and that like that's got to be a pretty big factor in the whole deal? Like that's news to people?
It seems to be. I mean, we should poll your listeners. I'm sure they're above average. I'm sure they know more than most people.
Of course, of course, of course.
Because they are unlocking their potential every day of the week. But yeah, I mean, it's a surprise. It's amazing how many women, it's amazing the size of the orgasm gap when you survey couples of all ages and you say what percentage, again, this is sort of a heterosexual assumption here, which obviously is not how all people have sex. But when you survey heterosexuals and you ask the men, you ask the women, like during your last sexual interlude, what percentage of the time did you have an orgasm? There's this giant difference. And so much of it is because the clitoris is not getting the attention it deserves. It's something like it's in the 90s for men, 90 something percent of men are having orgasms the last time they had sex. And it's like in the 50s to 60s for women, depending on the study. Interesting study that found that in order for a woman, there's a combination of three things you can do together as a heterosexual couple or a male-female couple that result in orgasms for the woman 92% of the time. And the combination of three things is, let's see if I can remember it off the top of my head, intercourse with clitoral stimulation, oral sex on her cunnilingus, and her stimulating her own body during sex in some way at some time during the interlude. If all those three things happen, 92% of the time there's an orgasm for the woman, which again, like, is that surprising? No, like any of those three things by themselves are likely to work. So all three of them, like, yeah, your odds are really high. But apparently that is not happening in a lot of bedrooms.
I also think there's a big gap, Jeff, between like what people know, like, okay, the clitoris is dense and nerve endings and the most pleasurable part versus what they do. I mean, I'm sure you get this all the time. People are like, I want to be an entrepreneur. I listen to all your podcasts. And they're like, well, I can't quit my day job. Like, I'm too afraid or whatever. Like, I think there's a similar thing where people seen, you know, some sort of Cosmo, you know, clickbait or whatever and have it in their heads. But in terms of being actually at that point where it's like, okay, I'm going to make this orgasm happen, whether it be getting up the nerve to just reach down and touch myself during intercourse or just do something, whatever it is to like knock it up to the next level, no pun intended, of like pleasure, then people are afraid. And then part of it is just helping people just feel more comfortable in their own bodies, communicating with their partner, just being who they want to be without having to sort of perform for some like imaginary camera that of course, you know, isn't there. It's just you and your partner. It doesn't matter what you look like or what matters is your pleasure. And that's a barrier for a lot of people to get there.
Yeah, you made a really good point. Like, you know, presumably very little of what you see in pornography would actually result in a female orgasm in the real world.
Yeah.
And so if that's actually if that's people's primary sex education, it's no wonder women are, you know, struggling.
And even aside from pornography, you just look at, you know, any movie where a couple has sex, you know, this could be R-rated movies. It's like, it's almost like the old fashioned, the basis, like first base, second base, third base, home run. It's like, you know, they kiss, they make out, they wind up in bed, they have intercourse. And the idea that there's anything that's going to give the woman an orgasm besides just penetration alone, that script doesn't include it.
So how do you start people? Like, let's say somebody's listening, like you said, they're going, oh, they already taught me how to like crack the door open because I'm going to go home and I'm going to tell my partner, hey, I heard this podcast on this Unlock Your Potential show. And there were these sexuality experts on there and they were talking about this and it made me think I want to talk about this. So let's say we've already given them the initial overture. But how do you coach people then? Like, because I mean, I believe you that people are gripped with fear and shame and anxiety and whatever around this subject. So for that person who's probably right now hanging on our every word going, yes, give me the magic word so I can have this conversation. How do you actually coach them to do it?
Well, one simple way, and there are now apps that do the same thing, but to do the old school way of sort of, especially for existing couples who have been in a relationship for a while, but maybe they have fantasies or things they've been sort of intrigued by a long time, but it can be scary to bring those things up or find what the new things are that might spice up your relationship, spice up your sex lives. So you can sort of play a game called Yes, No, Maybe, where you each, there are lists online, but you can also just brainstorm lists of like all the different sexual activities people might enjoy doing together, from really tame to really kinky. and you subdivide them privately, separately, into your yes category, the things you that like you think could be really fun to try, your no category that you're not interested in, maybe like, you know, depends on the situation, depends on maybe you have some details to negotiate. And the apps that do this for you will actually, they'll do the work of revealing to you both. You do it separately, but you're linked with a, you know, a code or whatever, your phone numbers. They'll reveal to you the yes categories that you both share, maybe the maybe categories that you share. So if it's something that you're maybe a little embarrassed about, but it's something, a fantasy that you have, and your partner doesn't share that fantasy, they'll never know that you have it. You don't have to tell them. But if you're a little shy about it and you put it in as a yes, and your partner also puts it in as a yes, even if they're shy, suddenly you discovered, oh my gosh, this is this fun new thing we've never tried before, but we know we're both interested in it. So that can really be a way to sort of kick things up to the next level. And instead of using an app, you can do it with paper, with pads of paper. And you can just say, okay, that one doesn't really appeal to me, but this one does. And you can, it doesn't have to be all secret and private. You can just share your list. I like this one. I don't think I'd want to do this one.
And your listeners may wonder, like, tell them, what are these apps? So one of them is called Kindu. Another is called Spicer. And there's also a website called Mojo Upgrade. We don't endorse or necessarily love any of those. Like, none of them is perfect, but they're worth sort of exploring and seeing which one might be a good match for you. But I think part of the question you were asking, Jeff, in terms of just sort of like what comes to mind, and maybe this is too detailed or too particular of an example, but I think it's a common situation where part of it is just like untangling the knot of how people get to where they are.
Mm-hmm.
What the next? So this is just an example, and I hope this isn't sort of too narrow, but I can give you an example of like sort of how we would think about this. Is, let's say, a long-term married couple, they have sex regularly, but in this case, the woman is always faking an orgasm, and her partner thinks that she's having an orgasm.
By the way, is that a pretty common thing that women fake?
Unfortunately, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well,
so I
want to be like, oh, those poor guys, but then again, like, how do you know? What?
Right. And this is a tough situation to be in either end of it, right? Because for a lot of us guys, we're like, oh, like, so a lot of your guy listeners just even hearing this are like, oh, I don't want to be like, I hope I'm not the one in this situation. And even some guys even ask us, like, is there a way to be able to spot a fake for sure? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, I mean, sometimes we have our audiences guess and they're like, you know, her leg shakes, her vaginal muscles tighten, her pupils dilate. And of course, all those may be signs of arousal, but not necessarily a guaranteed sign of an orgasm. But you can, the only way to know definitively for sure is to hook her up to a PET scanner, which is a medical device that measures brain.
That's practical.
Yeah, imagine.
That's how we sell them. No, we don't sell them.
What's it about? $3 million. So a lot. So it's like, okay, what to do? So I'm curious. I mean, I'm happy to keep talking, but do you want to jump in, Dorian, with how you would?
No.
I want to hear the example you were gonna go to.
Yeah. Right. So
set it up. You need to finish it off.
Yeah. You. By the way. Okay. So let me just say. Do you guys know how hard I'm having to bite my lip this whole damn conversation with the "That's what she said" or or "Oh, I saw what you did there." Like, you told her, like, "Oh no, you go first." And then like, oh no, that's too narrow. And like,
finish just off. Like,
yeah, finish this off. So anyway, sorry.
If you need a new career, you have potential as a sex educator. Like,
audiences love that stuff. And it's so, you just toss out to them. And they're like, oh, you're brilliant. You talk to us like, we do. Okay. But Marshall, you really do have to finish this off.
Okay. So let's say the woman comes to talk to us after whatever presentations. How do I fix this problem? Not having orgasms, my husband thinks I am. What do I do? So part of it is figuring out, like, okay, you're acknowledging that's a tricky position to be in. Because just saying to your husband, you know what? I've been faking for 10 years is not going to land well. That's going to hit pretty hard. In a way that may be difficult to sort of figure out what the next step is. Like, he's going to feel horrible. You're going to be like... So one way to work with that is like, okay, first figuring out with her, like, what does work in terms of her being able to have orgasms. And in a lot of cases, you know, if she's not having orgasms on her own, just encouraging her to sort of figure out how to make that work, whether literally on her own, like masturbating on her own, sort of figuring out like what does work in terms of her being able to have an orgasm. Often people in this situation are able to have orgasms on their own, just not with a partner, and then, or not with her husband in this case. And often there's something that could be different about that situation, usually that involves more clitoral stimulation. Like if they're just doing penetration for 5 minutes and then, or even for whatever, half an hour, but she's not getting the stimulation that, that she needs in order to, you know, push her over the edge. So the, so one way to work with that is sort of figure out for her what does work. Like, is oral sex what works? Is if you could get fingers in there at the same time, like sort of what would help? And then helping her to sort of figure out, are there moments, like, is she occasionally...
Fingers in there at the same time you're
talking. Yes, thank you.
Oral sex, not during penetration. Just in case anyone's like, oh, yes.
I knew what he was talking about for what it's worth.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that. One thing we never want to do is get people further off track than they already are.
Seriously. Okay, continue.
So if there are moments where she thinks she might be closer, if he could do more of that, like let's just say, keep it simple, like more time on oral sex, which for a lot of women really does work in terms of just having a partner who's patient, who's willing to take the time to really build arousal where she could have an orgasm, then finding the language for her to be able to say that, like, oh, you know, I mean, do you want to give the example, Dorian, or should I?
Might sound better coming.
What would everyone
right?
say?
She might be like, oh, that feels so good. Like that when you go down on me, that is amazing. And maybe if we could even do it a little longer, I would love to just see how that felt. So she can sort of find to praise what's working and encourage.
Like, so that sounded so straightforward. It's like, again, I don't mean to be like,
right,
what's wrong with people? But like, that's, I mean, you talked about being an English major. That's just like words put together as a sentence in the form of a request. Like,
right. And people joke that it's kind of like dog training where you like catch the behavior that you like and you encourage and you reward more of that and you encourage it. And, you know, and you maybe back off the faking a little bit. So you make possible like, well, I don't have an orgasm every single time. But, you know, sometimes I don't, but I'm still having a good time. And sort of at the same time that you're encouraging the behaviors and the things that you enjoy that actually might get you there, you can sort of gradually shift over to more real orgasms and fewer fake ones. And sometimes it's not going to happen, and making that okay too, having space.
So
for just like that was fun, but I didn't actually come.
Can you counsel a man that wants to talk to his wife or his partner about how to please her more, but she's really guarded and kind of doesn't want to talk about it, but maybe he also senses that she's not as fulfilled as she could be, and he genuinely wants to do better?
Before we answer that question, it makes me laugh because this is a question, when we are hiring people to be sex educators who work with us, this is exactly what we ask, because people always just say, well, just communicate, and to push people and say, communication isn't easy for all people in all situations. Okay, let's say that the girlfriend or the wife doesn't want to talk about it, just says like, it's fine, it's okay, and won't give you anything. Right. Then what do you do? Okay, but I still feel like this situation was, what should the man do? So then it's back to you, Marshall.
Sure. I mean, feel free to, you know, jump on these tough situations, but I think a common one. I mean, I think that the couple things going on here. One, I would reckon a great resource is the book Pure by Linda K. Klein. She's not addressing LDS in particular, but sort of evangelical kids who grew up under an evangelical sort of thinking about sex and what she calls purity culture.
Right.
So, and that describes about a third of all adults have in the US today have grown up with purity culture. So that if for your listeners, if this is the kind of thing they're thinking about, particularly if they're a woman sort of dealing with mixed messages in their head of, here's what I learned as a child growing up about sex, yet I'm now in a position of being an adult married woman or in a relationship, and just sort of how do I enjoy sex with my partner? That's a really great sort of resource of looking at it. But in terms of the situation of just having someone who's shy or quiet or may have a religious background or any number of reasons where they're just like, work with me here, like, hell, I'm trying to be a better partner is a common one. And I think part of it is, I think you've alluded to this, of for some people, communication is just so comfortable. Like talking about sex, or like even, you know, having been on a podcast or standing in front of an audience of 500 people and talking about sex, like, you know, for those of us who do it, it's just really easy. For people who don't do it at all, it can feel like a big leap to do anything. So for a lot of sex educators, being like, just communicate or say this, where people are, you know, they're describing like how to drive the car out of, you know, at 60 miles an hour, as opposed to like just how to ease it into drive. So I think finding ways in which people can just communicate a little bit more. So part of what we tell our audience is if your partner is doing something that you like, just make a little bit more noise. Like just even the slightest bit of moaning or like, and like if you feel comfortable, you can say right there, you know, two words that if your partner's on the right track, that can help.
Another tool that I think can be so simple and can really help people who are having, or the way that somebody doesn't want to talk or neither one of them wants to talk, is to give choices, to give two options, exactly the way the eye doctor does, where they give you two options, they're checking your eyes and they're like A or B, and you say B, and they're like, okay, B or C. Where you say, you know, does it feel better if I, you know, touch you this way or this way? If I kiss you this way or this way, like more tongue, less tongue, more whatever, less whatever. And you give these options and you start to get, and they're like, okay, I guess I like A a little better. And if you keep giving options over time, you can sort of find your way to either a really good pair of glasses or maybe more pleasure than you were experiencing and sharing before.
I like the way you mix the metaphor there.
Hey, it's Jeff here. If you liked this episode of Unlock Your Potential, it would mean so much if you would like and share the episode on whatever platform you're listening or viewing on. And if you really like what we're doing here and you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review. There is so much work that goes into these episodes, and you leaving a positive review lets us know that that work is reaching people, and especially it helps us reach other people. Your review could be the reason that someone else decides to tune in, check out this podcast, and unlock their potential and ultimately level up the quality of their life. So thank you so much for your support and for listening, especially if you like or share or leave a review. Thank you for helping us spread the word, and thank you for unlocking your potential to go make the world and your world a better place.